Welcome to the Wealthy, Wealthy, Wise podcast. If you would like to listen in on thought-provoking conversations with countercultural thought leaders and experts in the fields of wealth, health, and relationships, the three keys to having what I call a wealthy, wealthy life, then this is the show for you. I'm Christina Wise, real estate investor, best-selling author of Falling for Money, and founder of Wealthy Wealthy, where I serve as your personal guide to money, health, and happiness. Welcome back. This is Christina Wise, your host. In this episode, I interview Ron Lynch. Ron owns Big Baby Marketing and Ads Agency, and he is well known as a creative force in the digital marketing industry. He's written, directed, and executive produced over 90 long-form commercials and 300 traditional short-form TV ads. He's won numerous Telly and ERA awards, including Best Infomercial of the Year. Ron has helped guide product launches for several large companies, everybody's favorite being GoPro. He's helped entrepreneurs and Fortune 500 companies alike build brands through direct sales via TV and the web. Ron currently consults for a variety of consumer companies and does success coaching for elite marketers. In this episode, Ron gives the secret of how to flash grow your business to become a billion-dollar brand. On air, he even gives me advice that is certainly worth a million. He breaks down marketing into simple pieces that every entrepreneur can model and incorporate into their own business for fast growth. We talk money, the difference between earning it and making it, and how to create a lot of it by command. Ron is one of my favorite humans in the world. I love this conversation. Please enjoy my talk with Ron Lynch. Ron, I'm so excited for our conversation today. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Getting to know you recently, we've had, I think, some of the best conversations I've had this year. I always enjoy spending time with you immensely.
Oh, ditto. And, you know, it's just funny how life is. We met on the back of a boat, on Mike Dillard's boat, and a good friend of both of ours. And I didn't know who you were. I live in my little bubble, and all of a sudden, we're just chatting, everybody on the boat and having a good time. And you just asked this really thought-provoking question. I thought, damn, that is a good question. That really just stumped me a little bit. I had an automatic response, but then I really wanted to think about it. And I just thought, I need to know this man. I mean, who asks this type of questions on the back of a boat? And then come to find out, hell, you're so famous. Everybody knows you. Every time I say Ron Lynch, it's like I get to be a I'm special because I know you and I get to call you a friend and everybody's like, I love Ron Lynch. I love Ron Lynch. I'm like, I do too. Anyway, that was just such a special moment when I got to meet you. So, I just really appreciate
for me
you
too.
And the friendship.
Your reputation preceded you with me. I knew you were famous, so I was dying to meet you.
Well, I'm really excited about our conversation today. You are one of the leading marketers in the world and have worked with some of the biggest brands. And one thing I love about you is that you are extraordinarily talented and have built just an incredible business, have this incredible success story. And you're just such a great guy without one of those enormous egos that tend to go with big marketers, if you know what I mean. So I really can't wait to just dive into this a little bit today.
Well, I appreciate that. And I've never compared myself to anybody. So I've never felt a lack of or an overage of anything. And I've been very fortunate to be around people that were much more successful than me most of the time. So it's pretty easy to be humble when you're standing in the shadows of bigger people.
Well, anyway, well, there's a conversation. There's so many things I want to talk to you about today. And the first thing I'd like to jump into is to really pick your marketing brain a little bit. And you said some things the last time we met that really, I'm a terrible marketer. So it's something I'm wanting to learn a little bit is like, how do I become better at this? I'm great at teaching. I'm great at what I do, but I suck at marketing. And you were talking a little bit about the customer and your brand, but different than I'd heard it before. You were talking about it in a way of how certain brands resonate with a certain type of person. And one of your customers or clients was GoPro. And you said, so for example, GoPro are those that were the adventure seekers, the outdoors people, those that lived on the edge. And so GoPro that when you created the marketing for that, that's who you were going for, was that type of person as opposed to everyone. So can you talk more about that and some other brands and how it really resonates? And for those listening, Is coaching that comes to, like, how do you market to your type of person? Or how would I ask that?
So two things there. One is, if you're a good teacher, you are a good marketer. You're just not giving yourself credit for it. And I know that you're an excellent teacher. Good marketing is teaching. It's just putting the breadcrumbs out there for them to find you and always find the way back to you. So that relates to this second question that you bring up about GoPro specifically. One of the things that I have a course that I teach, and I do a lot of talks on this, is the idea that years ago, and not that many years ago, but prior to really internet marketing and the explosion of channels and everybody's accessibility to become a star and all of the stuff that comes along with the internet, it took a lot of money to brand a company. And so people from Wharton would say, you need five brand pillars and we need to express these five brand pillars everywhere the person runs into us and blah, 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 blah. And the internet really, and multi-channel marketing on television really, you know, the explosion into 1,000 TV channels really helped break that model. And it's actually become, I think, simpler. But most people who are in marketing or launching a company don't see it simply. And with GoPro in particular, as the example, if you think of what we're really selling in these big brands now is, and it wasn't a big brand when I met them, it was only, their sales were about $600,000 a year, is this idea of what's the merit badge, the character trait the customer is adopting when they adopt your brand. So when you say it's adventuresome, yes, I'd say adventuresome is the outcome, but the actual badge that they're getting is bravery. And people are codifying their personalities in social media, just like we're Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, putting about 8 badges on ourselves. And if I have the GoPro badge, I have the bravery badge. And then if I have, say, the Lululemon badge, I have the fitness, like smart fitness. If you have a Tesla badge, like you could have a Tesla or you could have a Subaru. And you can see as you start to make these combinations, then the individual has these different combinations. It's kind of the combination to their character, and it's how they portray themselves in the world. Because of social media and the internet, everybody wants to be relevant and everybody wants to be seen, and there's an opportunity to be seen. So when you're going to be seen and you're not maybe the best communicator in the world, this is a really simple shortcut to go, hey, here's my merit badges. This is who I am.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes so much sense. And when we talked about that when we had coffee a few weeks ago, that really struck out to me because I thought I've always been a little bit of the anti-badge person. I didn't really resonate with labels or badges. But I thought, you know, I actually have badges too. If I thought about that, if I were to be honest, that there are those certain things like, yeah, Christina has a Range Rover badge. Why? Because I like the little off-road type thing, but still a little bit of sassy and a little bit of luxury. But, you know, and that's very much my personality. You know, it's a little edgy. It's off-road, but it's still a little classy and luxury type thing. Yeah. And it's like, that's why I resonate with that brand as opposed to other car brands. So once we left, I thought, you know, I want to really go deeper with this. So what are some other, let's say, badges that you're seeing from your vantage point?
Well, if you look at, let's look at Dave Asprey and Bulletproof. You tell me, what do you think that represents in one or two words? What's the badge?
Just a little bit of a hacker outside the norm, like doing something a little bit countercultural maybe?
Yeah, and then, but there's a promise with that coffee that it's going to make your brain work a certain way. It's like smarter. It's coffee, but smarter. It's not your truck stop coffee. It's your genius coffee, right? And so when we start to look at these kind of one by one and go, what is this saying about me? Now, here's the trick to this, or here's the key to it. I think that there's products that you absolutely can't do it for. Like you can't do it for commoditized products. This will never work for toilet paper. You're not going to get into a commoditized business. If you're starting a business or you're growing a business, you're probably in a business that has some innovation to it. So if you have some innovation, then you just are defining that innovation. And my belief around this, and I think that there's a lot of evidence to back this up, particularly in the last 10 years, is if you do a good job of this, you get your customers to sell your product for you, and your marketing becomes, I'm not going to say viral, I'm going to say valid, sociologically valid, that people are out there pushing your brand on your behalf. And there's some companies out there like Ducks Unlimited. This is an organization of conservationist hunters. But those duck, you see a truck with or a car with the duck on it, and you're like, oh, yeah, that person's using that sticker to codify who they are, an Apple sticker on a car or whatever. So I think that that's – I think it's the secret to going from zero to $1 billion as a company rapidly, that you can chug along and get to $1 billion in 10 or 20 or 30 years like some companies do. But if you can identify this and effectively communicate it and get your customers go out there and sell the idea for you, you're going to grow super fast.
That really is the secret to massive compounding expansion overnight. And so I think of some brands like that, GoPro would be one, Yeti, for example. So what would be the badge with Yeti that all of a sudden it's just another cooler out there and now it's a $1 billion company?
Right. So here we were in the cooler business for, you know, coolers have been around 100 years and we know who the cooler company is. It's been, you know, it's been either Coleman or Igloo. There's been two brands, both commoditized brands at the bottom. Now, what is intrinsic to a Yeti cooler is prestige. Is I'm not a redneck. Even though I have this truck, you can tell by the $600 cooler that I'm carrying around in the back of it that even though I'm a little bit country, I'm a lot of rock and roll. And that has gone into all of their I would guess that they sell more in ancillary products outside of those coolers now than they do coolers, because people give me Yeti, like the coffee mugs, all the time. And I love them, but I probably have six of the kind of, they're like the short wine goblet. Like I have a couple pairs of those in a couple different colors. There's people out giving those. And that's another interesting thing about this is the gift giving of these, what I'm going to call brands or prestige brands or identity driven brands, is that people like to give them as gifts. And if you can get your customers to start gifting your product, you're really onto something.
Now, what about something, I'm just going to be a little selfish here. What about when I'm looking at my brand, for example, I don't really have a product. I more or less have a service. I'm trying to transform and change people the way they think, the way they act, the way they, what they believe in this category called money. And I wouldn't even know the first place to start to try to badge that somehow.
If you don't mind, we'll do it.
Okay.
I think that might be interesting for people to listen to. So let's talk about what specifically is innovative about your work? What stands apart from what other people do? And I'll back build this. This is the way I do this with clients. Let's just start with your features and then we'll get to the benefits, because it's probably going to be easier to go, hey, I recommend these types of things. And this is the kind of conventional thinking that I break down. So give me, say, three or four examples of your thinking that is generally different from the general marketplace of people that do what you do.
Well, I teach people how to think about money and in a way that they've never been taught to think before. And so when people learn from me, a feature of that would be it's a radically different backwards way to think about money that they've never thought of before. It's never been exposed to them before, that once they get it, they're like, holy shit, why haven't I ever heard this before? Why haven't I been taught this before?
Okay. And yeah, and you and I've had lots of talks about money. So let's go there. Cause I think you really nailed it actually. And the very first thing that you said is I teach people how to think about money. So if I were to reverse engineer that marketing to the consumer, I would say, do you think about money? Were you taught to think about money? Or were you told to save money, put it in a 401k, maybe invest in a stock portfolio and buy some real estate? Is that what you know about money? Because you don't really know that about money, do you? That's what you were told about money. Now, would you like to think about money? And would you like to know how to think about money? Because it's scary, isn't it? Well, I'm going to teach you how it's not scary by really thinking about it. Would you be curious? Because if you are curious, the people who I teach to think about money gain a lot of it rapidly. Would you like that?
Boom. That's amazing, Ron. Holy shit.
But just by stopping and going, what do I have that's different? How rapidly can we create a dialogue that makes somebody go, pick me. Yeah, I want to know that. But you see, I didn't make it about you. You see how rapidly I took your idea and I spun it and made it about them. Mm-hmm. And what I tell all of my students is, and my clients, is marketing is a mirror. And you go around the world and you put these mirrors out and make sure that they see their reflection wherever they go. And they will stop and they will realize you are the one that's giving them the reflection. And they are your customer at that point. They will discover you.
Yeah, that's so helpful because, again, where marketing stumps me is that since I don't think that way, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put that on a landing page right after we hang up. But, so thank you. Yeah. But so I don't really know prior to this conversation, like how to attract people because I don't know how to say what I do in a way that you just framed it. But then once people go through it, then they're like, it's the after effect. It's like, I don't know how to really attract people on the front end. But once the few people that do, however many, the few is, those that do, then they go and they're like, holy cow, I've never experienced this before. So I don't know how that front end piece.
So you do know the front end piece because you just explained it. Again, I'm going to tell you back what you just told me.
Okay.
First thing you said was you set up this question of, I teach people how to think about money. And I just responded, people don't think about money. So then I gave you a small soliloquy that walks them in. So the next part is going, would you like to know what the result is? Here's Kathy. She went to my seminar. Here's Bill. I've worked with him. Here's Teresa. We worked together for 2 years. Here's Kevin. We worked together for 2 days. And let those people tell the transformation that they had. And what they didn't understand, and just now what we're starting to do is we're starting to break into consumer psychological funnels. So in GoPro, I had a skier, I had a water skier, I had underwater, because these all represent different types of people, but they also, if you think about it, represent different types of benefits and features of the product. Underwater is safe to put underwater, camera sealed in the housing, you get great photography. Skiing is motion related and cold related and selfie related. Out in the wilderness and I've got mittens on, it's a pain in the ass to deal with a camera, but this works great. Then there's car racing, and car racing is low vibration. Like cars are when you race a car. So what you're doing is we're taking all of the media now and splitting it up, and you do that with your testimonials. So now you've got five testimonials that are talking about the five main customer avatars that you have. And one of the things that people do is they get lost in testimonials or get bored. And one of the ways that I help people avoid that is I'll take five or six testimonials together and I'll edit them so that it feels like five people telling Goldilocks and the Three Bears or Little Red Riding Hood. So the first person says, Little Red Riding Hood was walking through the forest on her way to her grandmother's house. And the second person says, and she came upon the house and the door was cracked open and she leaned in. And the third person says, and when she leaned in, the house smelled funny and everything was a mess, but she saw her grandmother tucked under the cover. So when you stitch it all together, you get the credit as a marketer for having five people all agree on every detail of the story just by telling their segment of the story. And if you order that correctly, now it appears as though all of your customers have the same understanding, knowledge, and experience thanks to you. So you have trust. So you had interest, then you have proof, now you have trust.
Wow.
Now you need offer.
And it's that simple.
Unfortunately, is that something? So that's why I always laugh when people say you're a genius. And I'm like, I'm not a genius. I'm as dumb as your dumbest customer.
But you are. I mean, I think genius really lies in the simplicity of being able to distill things down to the most simple format or framework or structure. So,
yeah. Well, and we live in a world where everybody's going, here's my thing. I want you to buy it. Isn't this? This is what it does. And this is like that. No. I'm like, are you thirsty? Wouldn't hot cocoa taste great right now? It's cold out. You know, instead of here's my shiny cup, buy it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you have to say about where, let's say, everybody's an expert, everybody has a voice, everybody has something to sell, everybody with all the social media, with just so much noise and so much, I don't know even how to describe it, but do you even pay attention to that? Do you see something here, or how do you describe it, and how do you play in this world?
So I don't, I think that I there's a couple of things to say about that. I think one is obviously not everybody is an expert. Not everybody has the experience. So you go, hey, can you validate the fact that you're screaming louder than everybody, about, you know, multiple Xing your business or this, that, or whatever the thing is, whatever the claim's being made. But at the same time, I look at everybody's perspective and see what I can find in it of value. So I'll give you an example. We had an exercise product years ago that looked big and bulky. It was actually very inexpensive to manufacture, but it didn't appear to be that way. And we were so we could afford to sell this for about, I think it was $249 or $199. This is back in the early 2000s. And we couldn't sell it. We had a half hour show and we could not sell this piece of exercise equipment. So then we went out and we were like, oh, we'll narrow the margin. We'll bite the bullet and give some free gifts. Can we sell it for $179, then $149? Then we'll just go to multi-pays. Let's see, can we do it for three payments of $39 or four payments of $49? And we just could not figure this out. And we were on set and one of the PAs, who was about 19 years old, walked on set and he goes, oh, this is cool. And he had not seen it before. I'm like, yeah. And he said, ah, that looks expensive. What is it, about $800? And I went, yes, let's sell this for $800 because that's what it looks like. Suddenly everything worked because the perception of the price at $199 was it must be junk. The exact same thing, perception of the price at $800 worked.
That's wild.
And the product worked for a very long time. So that came from a PA. And if I had just been like what I think most people would do, be like, no, you idiot, it's $199. What, aren't you supposed to be getting me tea now? Because that's how it is on set. You know, that's how people behave. Mm-hmm. And I've never thought that way. Probably because of my upbringing. But I value people's opinions. And so I look with scrutiny, but I'm not foolish. So that's probably the best advice I can give you is listen, but don't be suckered.
Yeah, that's good. Now, when it comes to when you're looking through all the noise and let's say there's some really valid, really good products or services out there that just aren't breaking through the noise, would you say that it really is a marketing issue that they're just saying, hey, buy this cup. It's got all, you know, it's red and it's got all these, you know, things about it, as opposed to, like you said, it's cold outside. Are you thirsty? Right.
Yeah. It's 9 times out of 10, or they haven't surveyed customers. Like you'll find like a hierarchy of things that the customer wants. And they're trying, and typically people are trying to sell everything that they have feature wise in one ad to every consumer. And I think that's a huge mistake. I think you need to break it down and go, okay, we have three audiences. That might mean that we have three different benefits that each one, we might be able to provide 12 benefits, but people can only really remember about three things. So what three benefits does this audience need versus that audience versus that audience? Then what product configuration do they need? And then what offer do they need? Now, I did not create Proactive, but I have a good relationship with Guthy Renker. I've had businesses with him over the years. And Proactive was a product that has three distinct audiences: mothers that are buying it for their teenage sons, young women that buy it, and adult women that are buying it for themselves. And they have three price points, and they have three different size sets of SKUs for the because they figured it out. And they started like everybody else with one SKU offering and one offer. And they realized in their data that if they divided it into three, each and their media budget, that each one of those became much more efficient and successful. And I think that that's the danger of people of, hey, you need to A-B test. Well, yes, you do need to A-B test. But just because A beats B doesn't mean that you throw B in the garbage. You C test then. Then you D test, and you start to find out what creates a functional marketing plan from the customer to you. If you're in the ice cream business, would you just sell one flavor?
No.
But if you were forced to sell one flavor, it better be vanilla.
Mm-hmm. So people come to work with you when you take on a new client. What does that look like? Like, what are you from when you're sitting across the table and you're inquiring and you're learning, you're asking these types of questions? Can you walk me through that process, like what that looks like, that allows you or enables you to pull out these different parts that are just overlooked? Because we're all so excited about our product and what we're doing that we're missing all of what you just spoke to.
Right. And it's also dependent upon what do you have that exists? Do you have data and customers that exist that we can look at? And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. So the approach is different if you have nothing and then if you have data. If you have data, that's kind of where we start. And then we go into the process. But the process is not unlike what I just did with you, was what is the unique thing that you think you're selling? So what's your problem? What's the solution that you have for the problem? What's innovative about the solution? What's the unique selling proposition of that? And then I typically have them talk about what the features are, then what the benefits are for those features. And then we start to break that down. Okay, what type of customer wants three of those benefits? And start to figure out who the audiences are. Then start to match all of those up and then create a sales argument. Now, I leave at that point and go and create the sales argument and the offers and then come back and present those. But the first day with a client is interrogative, is I'm just simply extracting what their current belief is about what they've created. And that may be someone who's just invented something, who hasn't gone to market, or someone who's struggling in market, or someone who's succeeding in market. So, like Samsung, I do robotics for them, robotic vacuum cleaners. And one of the things we discovered after going to market, because we launched their product, we very rapidly learned from the research that, not surprisingly, 80% of the product, 70% was bought by women. Now, I'm not saying that 70% of the product was bought by women because it's vacuum cleaners. 70% of all products are bought by women, period. That is just, if you have to paint the world with a broad brushstroke, that's true. And we discovered in this process that there were two specific types of women that were ordering this vacuum cleaner. One was over 55 and the other was 30 to 45. And the 30 to 45-year-old was typically a pet owner and a mom. And the 55-year-old was typically an empty nester and often had grandkids and a pet. So you have these two women that are purchasing this product. Now, how do you do a television creative that you represent both of those customers? Do you put a mom and a grandma in a house? Whose house do you pick? Like, there's all of this stuff that comes up. And so the cognitive choice that I made was to eliminate both. And I didn't put any women in the ad. I just put the baby and the puppy. That way the person would insert themselves in the creative. So I was going to TV. I didn't have endless streams of money to make endless commercials. And we had to get a few different things done in a few different commercials because there were some other customer verticals as well. So to deal with this kind of person who is in relationship with a puppy or a kid, that's how we did it. So sometimes what you leave out is important.
Right.
So it's, that's how the process works generally. And I duplicate it over and over, and that's why it's teachable. That's the weird thing to me is nobody teaches this in the world. Like when I figured out how to do creative briefs, I was Googling creative briefs 20 years ago. And what I was discovering was it was a 2-page thing and was strictly talking about the product and logos and colors and stuff like that. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. So I just started doing these 20-page briefs. And when you hand them back to a company, they can drive the business. Like GoPro used the creative brief I created for them in 2007, before we were ever on TV, for 9 years.
Wow.
Same document.
So the way I listen to this is it's let's say marketing in general is a real framework for how to break down these different parts. Where does direct response marketing fit into this as far as like real online? And is there a different?
No, it's the same process. What you have to understand in the context of this as someone who's starting out is that there's steps for the consumer. One, I think all of it starts with empathy. I'm never trying to sell anything. I'm always trying to take the consumer side and empathetically going, what if I was them, what would I need to experience? What would I need to hear? What would I need to see? Then in online, I have a methodology that breaks this down into a series of things. So I do a very short ad that gets their attention typically. Then I pixelate, and then that short ad will have an offer. Then I'll come back to them with a second ad that's descriptive, often an animated ad, so they really get and understand what the product does for them without any judgments of actors, colors, blah, blah, blah. They just get kind of the diagram understanding of this is what the product can do for me. Then the third piece is usually another creative. Again, all of these have CTA. All of these have a transactional element. Go here to purchase, here to get 10% off, here's $150 off, here's how to find a deal. And the third piece would be something that's demonstrative. And demonstrative might be part testimonial or part man on the street. Like we have a breath mint product, and our third spot in the sequence is getting people outside of a restaurant, stopping them on the street, having them smell each other's breath after a meal. So it's awkward. And it's funny. And then they take the product, and the product is like Pop Rocks, it pops. And then they smell each other's breath again. And then they start having these conversations of, well, let's go home and make out. And yeah, now we can snuggle. And so you've taken this customer from the problem of garlic breath through the joy of the innovation of the product and a demo where they experience it and they're telling me about it. And it's all testimonial driven. So you know you're being told the truth as the viewer. That sincerity piece is there. And then at the end, you get this Shazam. It's sexual attraction and the thing that we all want. And it's like, okay, I get what the benefit of this product big time. And it's it's really, you can start stitching these together and you have an infomercial. Mm-hmm. My online marketing path is really a long form infomercial pulled apart into all its incremental pieces. And I sequence it just like an infomercial.
And that was your beginning, right? Was infomercials?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, prior to that, I was a retail grocer. So yeah, I went from retail grocery and filmmaking directly into infomercials. So I've been doing infomercials and TV commercials and online commercials for almost 20 years.
And I guess when you're dealing with a commercial, you have to nail these pieces because you have a very short period of time to capture that customer, to get them intrigued, to bring them into the narrative, to convince them that this product will solve their problem or create the lasting effect or result that will make their life better or happier.
Yeah. And I'm reinventing a wheel that already existed. I mean, it goes back to David Ogilvy and Dan Kennedy and everybody in between us, that the methodology is the same. I just think in today's culture, it really has to be more of a mirror and more sincere than ever if it's going to work. And not everything I do works. I don't want to give you that impression. Most of the stuff I've learned from my failures. But I think this idea of it being a mirror and being super sincere, because people are really good TV producers. People can smell BS coming and going.
Yeah, I was going to actually go there next is there's also now the phenomena of really great marketers who are great at creating the sizzle and great at creating the purchase, but there's nothing behind really the upfront sale. And so I know I find myself now, and I'm just getting hit with ads all the time. And it's like, turn off everything in a way. It's like too much. And so how much do you see that's happening and what to do to break through? You just feel like I just feel like I'm marketed to all the effing time.
You are. But what the other thing that's weird though, is because of the digital age and how this is occurring, if you have control of the channel, it's kind of self-serve advertising. We're getting to the point, Facebook and YouTube are really great examples of you're only going to be served stuff that you're probably interested in. Outside of that TV in the world, you're not. There's, you're still hit with 60,000 marketing messages a week and your brain's trying to filter through that. But we all know that if something pops up in our timeline, there's a little thing in the back of your head that says, you asked for that.
Yeah,
you clicked on that thing. You brought that one on yourself. And then there's stuff you're like abstractly like, how did this get here? But that becomes less and less over time. Mm-hmm. I sincerely believe that what's going to happen with blockchain and the way data is stored and the way that this is going to break one of two ways, and I hope it breaks this way, that individuals get control over their online identity and their online finances and can self-select avatars for themselves. So I won't know that I'm Ron Lynch, and you know, the world won't see that, and the world won't necessarily see Christina Wise. They'll see K-Wise, because you've decided to pick that name for here, and Christina W for that, and you kind of like Seinfeld and George's worlds colliding. You have your work world and your family world and your recreational world or whatever that is. And there's multiple identities, but you self-select for those identities what type of media you want and what type of advertising. So you'll go through, not unlike, you know, Netflix or something, you'll go click, 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 click. This is what I want. And don't ever show me this stuff. And you'll be gratified by that type of advertising. And they will charge a super premium to the advertisers because you have willfully given up your data and said, I'm definitely interested in Land Rover type SUV products.
Right on. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. You know, one thing when we're on the boat, you throw out a money question, and that's what I loved. I'm like, oh, now we're talking. And what I picked up from that is you think differently with money and you just operate it with it differently. I mean, I just picked that up right off the bat, which was very intriguing to me because it was different. So I'd love to get a little bit of your point of view. You've been a big marketer. You've worked with these big brands. You've made a lot of money and you have a business that does very well. Tell me your thoughts about money. Like how do you see yourself thinking differently than, let's say, the masses?
Well, I'll tell you, part of the thinking has come from losing a lot of money too and making poor choices with money. So I have not, I'm not one of those people that has the first dollar that they ever earned. I've gone up and down and I've had to learn some really tough lessons. And what I learned over time was I was utilizing the chase of money to fulfill inadequacies in myself. If I have this, then I'll be, then other people will think I am. And once I guess I got to a certain age where I was like, I don't care what, like, I don't want people to think about me. And then fact is, they're probably not even thinking about you. So how do you enjoy your time and your life? And then, okay, what do I need to finance my time and my life the way that I want to do that? Once I started to kind of unwind from that, and again, this took two or three crashes with money to get to, the idea came to me one day, and I think I was probably in a conversation with our mutual friend, Jesse Elder. And this is probably 6 or 7 years ago. And we were both wrestling with this concept, and we have a group of guys, and Jesse and probably David Gonzalez and Mike are kind of consistent threads in that group. And there's some guys that kind of float in and float out of that group. And we have these little kind of little philosophical evenings, and Tucker's one of those people. And we wrestled these questions, and I was just listening to us talk, and I kind of had this out of body experience and I just turned to him and I said, what does money equal? And somebody said, well, it equals freedom. Another person said, well, it equals choices, because if you have money, you can make choices. Another person said, well, for me, it's security. And I went, huh. Because I asked you a math question. If I asked you what 7 equaled, would you say security? Would you say freedom? Would you say choices? And everybody laughed. And I'm like, but the way our culture has us so brainwashed, because your brain's tied together with the media that you've seen your entire life. The way that we're brainwashed, we're taught that money equals things. And the fact of the matter is 7 equals 7. Therefore, money equals money. And if it wasn't true, then 0 money would mean 0 success. 0 money would be 0 choices. 0 money would be 0 opportunity. 0 money would be 0 security. Well, that's not true. I have a sense of security even when I've been broke, or a sense of opportunity, or a sense of choices. So that's patently false, so then what is money? And the answer comes much closer to money is, and it's funny, I was just working on Money Revealed with Jeff Hayes, and Garrett Gunderson's a good friend of mine, and we spend time together, and I was watching some tape of Jeff, and I mean, of Garrett, and he blurted out, money is a byproduct resource. And I just like screamed at the screen. I'm like, that's what I've been saying for 10 years to people. Like, money is a byproduct resource. And your core resources are first Maslow's hierarchy. From oxygen to the roof over your head. Water, food, shelter, blah, blah, blah. That's the first 10. Then you get to the second, and it goes from health into more esoteric things. The reason it does is because for humans to survive, you must get into a tribe. Hunters die as hunters. They have to be in a tribe because they have to have gatherers. They have to have medicine men. They have to tool makers. They have to have, we have to have each other. So to get in the tribe, you must take your core resources, which are observation, critical thinking, problem solving. These are actual resources that you pay nothing for. They're in you. And with those, you put them together and you do something in the external world that others see value in, and money's created. So the more rare and specified and valued the thing that you create is, the more of this byproduct resource called money you have. Which is why the chief and the medicine man and the shaman and they work the least in the tribe. They're the ones that sit around. They have the highest revenue, so to speak. And the rest of us hunters and gatherers are out there hunting and gathering. And they're living off the benefit of our work. In today's age, anybody can move from being hunter to chief. Just like that with the right idea. All you have to do is go have enough empathy to find somebody's problem that's deep enough and solve it in a creative enough way that the tribe values the solution and starts talking about the solution, which is this idea of branding. See how like this is all thoroughly connected? Mm-hmm. And it's simple, but we are so starving. We run after our starvation and our thirst. And we go, I just need money. And we end up chasing money like it's leaves in the wind instead of building sailboats for the wind.
Yeah, I mean, you're just so right on. And it's the world that I observe in all the time is this just constant chase for the money. Like it's out there somewhere. I just need to go chase it. I need to go find it. I need to go get it. I need like it's out there.
And then I need to post it on Instagram so that I feel good enough about myself. And the weird thing is when you do that, you're going after love and pride. And what you're getting is jealousy and hatred from the crowd. Mm-hmm. You get the exact opposite of what you were intending to do.
So I talk a lot about this as well. And I know it's something that you mentioned when we spoke, and it's this, the difference between like really like earning money and making it. And, mm-hmm. and I have my own way I talk about that, but I would love the way you think about it. What are your thoughts? Like, how would you distinguish the difference?
So I think that earning money is what most of us are trained to do, and we're culturally programmed. Go to college, get a job, or go get in a trade association and become an HVAC person and exchange your hours in the most efficient way to get money from the tribe. So kind of the first thing that we talked about there. But how it becomes transformative when you go to making money. Now what you're doing is money made instead of money earned is money made is based upon asset creation. Is if I borrow X from the bank, buy this piece of land, bring in the lumber and the workers, the gross commodity that I put together at the end of the day is now worth more than all of the parts. The sum is greater than the parts. And so there's this piece of property in the world that now has this value that didn't exist before. Another way that works, this is more abstract, but it's true, is I could go down, if I was known as a great painter, like my friend Ori paints a lot of the paintings in our house, Ori's a great painter, and he probably, I think he does this digitally, but let's just say he's got about $60 or $80 of supplies in his paintings, yet he sells his paintings for $2,000 or $3,000, and I buy that painting. So you might think that's work for hire, but the paintings are assets. They exist in the world still. And if you take that idea to the extreme, and I love J.K. Rowling as the example, here she had these crazy ideas for these books in her head. She wrote the books became valuable, the movies became made. Now there's this whole library, this body of work that's worth billions of dollars that came out of her head. That's making money. That money did not exist in the world before. That is an asset that she created. That asset can now be leveraged. And here's the key point. You take this asset and you go, I own the J.K. Rowling library, or I own the Beatles library. And the bank goes, that's fantastic. You'd like to buy a house. Yep. Buy your house. Put your money in our bank. They legally now can go print 9 times the deposit value of your asset. Whatever asset you're leveraging, they can go print 9 times the money. And now there is $9 billion floating in the marketplace to be loaned, to be shared, to be fed back into our economy that wasn't there. And people get radically angry that billionaires are not paying taxes. The tax code is written so that people will create assets to grow the economy in this way. And that's what they don't teach you in school. These guys aren't doing something shifty to not pay taxes. They're actually following the rules of the game that creates more wealth for the world. And the wealth wouldn't have been there. If you take away half of Jeff Bezos' $150 billion, you've pulled the tentpole out of Amazon. And the 140,000 or whatever it is employees that work there are now in jeopardy, so are their jobs. And you can immediately go, oh, suddenly I get trickle-down economics. There's something to that. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think about it. So I don't curse the wealthy. I don't pray to them either. I just understand how the game's played.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you say? Thank you, by the way. And I completely agree. 100% agree with you with everything you just said. And that makes me think too, is I teach a concept called money magic, and it's still the same thing. Like, people are out there like working hard for the job, for the paycheck, or they think they're out in the chase and just all this finagling and all the nonsense that might go out in that, you know, that chase. And to me, the beauty, like the magic of money, like, we are money. We're creators. So it's creators and innovators and problem solvers. And like you said, with the empath to want to help and change and make transformation and make the world better and create that in something that can be offered and exchanged. And like you said, but build it in a way that has an asset value and can multiply many times over. But the magic is here. Like, it's all in the inside out. It's not out there somewhere that we're trying to bring in. And it's just the complete opposite, a way to orient around money and creation of that. Now, I work with that said, and that's what I love about entrepreneurialism, is it like, we as entrepreneurs are the ultimate creators. Like, we are taking something from nothing, some radical, crazy idea in our head that's just imagined. And then we create real properties out of it, like get it out of our head and make it into something that can be offered. That's magic. Like, it came from nothing but a silly, harebrained idea that popped in somewhere with all this passion and energy and desire, like, ah, this is going to make the world a better place. So that's where the money is. It's the inside. And then how well we can turn that into maybe a product or service, even market that and all these other, you know, more, how well we can be at the skill at these different business pieces. But what I hear a lot with the entrepreneurs, I work with a lot of high level entrepreneurs that are really confused, I think, by so much of this, is that they just want to make money and go out and make more money. One, and thinking that that's enough. Or two, there are a lot of creatives. They say, I don't want to worry about the money. I just want to create. So you're such a creative. What is your thought about that as a creative? Someone that's just so brilliant in your innovation, the way you think, the way you create, the way you tap into that creativity. How do you move from, hey, I just want to create and not worry about this, versus how do I take that creativity and like mass produce it in a way?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to say about that. One is, I think that a lot of people will say, hey, that person's so lucky, or that person's so smart. And most of the entrepreneurs I know are neither. It's simply desire. You use that word desire right in the middle of that. And it's simply a choice. And if you're saying that person's too smart, you're actually making a choice and you're not being cognizant or being honest with yourself about the choice you're actually making. You're choosing not to. You're opting out. You're saying, I can't. Well, the fact of the matter is you can. Anybody can. I'll give you an example. I recently learned of a person. I haven't met this person firsthand yet, but they were looking for a rental house because they weren't making enough money to live in the house that they were living. They were kind of living on their means and they had to kind of recoil. And so they went and they found this house that they really liked. And then they realized that they had made a commitment to leave for 2 months in the middle of the year and wouldn't be able to make the rent payment in these two particular months. As they were negotiating with the landlord, they said, could I rent this out for South by Southwest here in Austin just for a couple of weeks? Because I think in 1 or 2 weeks, I could make the rent payment for the 2 months. And the landlord said, what if you don't make it? And the person said, well, I'll put it on my credit card if I don't make it. And the landlord went, okay, go ahead. So they made this arrangement. And then the person went home and they realized what they had done and called the landlord and said, well, since I'm going to Airbnb this and you agreed to this, have you ever considered, could I like get 10 of your houses? And could I rent those for the next 2 years? And we'll pick desirable houses in Austin that we can Airbnb all the time, because I can, if I just rent them out for 5 days a month, I will make the rent payment on each one of those houses. And the landlord said, absolutely not. But what I will do is I'll partner with you on it and we'll share the money. If you manage it, I'll do it. And this person did it. And they immediately quit their job, tripled their income, and hired an agency to run the Airbnbs for them. This person is not, I'm going to say not smart, but not dumb. They're just a normal person who made that decision. Mm-hmm. And you might go, oh, that's brilliant. It's not really that brilliant. He was driven to the decision by the force of the situation that he was in. But once he recognized the situation, he went, oh, wait a minute, I could do this again. Because his brain was open to doing it again.
Yeah, and it's just the creativity of coming up with a solution as opposed to, I can't make rent, life sucks, or this happened to me, and you know, I heard all my excuses. It's like, all right, here's the situation. Let's invent a way to make this win for everyone. And
this person's 40. This is not a 24-year-old genius that came from Stanford. This is a person who has worked their whole life in a job and just decided, I'm sick of this. I got to do this a different way. Anybody can make that decision.
You're right. All right, let's switch gears again one more time. We're starting to come to our time together. You and I could talk forever. I could ask you questions forever and ever and ever and ever. So I'm curious about Ron. I mean, we've got a sense of Ron for your brilliance, your expertise, why you're so successful, by how simple you just solved my marketing problem within like 2 minutes. But who's Ron? Like if Ron said, if you really knew me, you would know that.
Again, I have to go back to simple things. I'm not very complicated. I like to cook, I like music. I like to play music. I like to tell jokes. I like to think about things in a funny way. And, you know, I like abstraction. I also like organization. I like tidiness. Not super crazy, you know, not neurotic about it, but like, I'm getting old enough that I need to know where things are. And I'm generally, when I'm not in a situation that's highly social, I'm pretty introverted. I spend a lot of time by myself and I spend a lot of time thinking and planning and, you know, I sleep 6 hours a night and I'm generally meditate for in kind of a delta state from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. and plan my day, my writings, whatever I'm going to do. I interview my friends before I picked them, as you know. I interviewed you the first time that we met. I think, was that awkward for you?
I loved it. It was brilliant. It's beautiful. It just felt so good, actually. And no, I'd never been interviewed before for a friendship. And you were serious. You had your journal and you're writing down the answers. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, I. But the reason I do that is because I know that I'm mortal and I have finite time, so I don't want to waste it. That is the one commodity in life that can't be replaced. We are living inside of this gigantic cosmic clock that's ever expanding and moving. And so, like, if I laugh when people say, "If I could go back 100 years," well, really, do you realize if you went back 100 years, you'd be sitting in the vacuum of space because the Earth wasn't here 100 years ago? It's a completely different spot. So, like, we're in this clock that's moving and it doesn't go backwards. So we have to cherish every single day, every moment, every relationship, and still find in the cataclysm of knowing that our death is impending and it's definitely going to happen, even though we kind of think it's going to happen to everybody else but us, but it's definitely going to happen. How do you find joy in that? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my, a couple years ago, I decided, you know what, that's going to be my mission, is I'm just going to try to find joy every day and in every moment and in every relationship and every project. And if it's not joyful or fun and it's not helping somebody else, because I realize that I'm happy when I'm helping and giving, and then I take some time for myself as well. That's it. It's not complicated. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a God. A lot of people, you know, like, they're either afraid to say that or that makes them nervous. I'm not afraid to say that I believe there's a God. Because it's as difficult for me to look at this incredible snow globe and go, this just happened. That's almost preposterous to me. And I think that a lot of us spend our lives going, God, can you see me? Am I here? Am I relevant? And God is on the outside of the snow globe looking in going, look around the snow globe. How could you not see me? Am I relevant? Do you see me? And we're asking the same question of God that God is asking of us. Do you see me?
Wow. All right. Wow.
Probably more than you wanted to know.
No, that just touched my soul. So what are you most proud of?
Probably the survival of the great relationships that I have. I still have friends from literally from kindergarten. I've been smart enough and lucky enough to find people that were forgiving enough to keep me around. Mm. I think it's the relationships are the thing that I'm proud of.
I love that. All right. Well, we're going to wind this down and I close all my podcasts with one final question. And I like doing a little myth busting. And you're an unconventional thinker. You're an unconventional actor in this crazy world we live in. So what do you see quite frequently that you would like to call out?
That the guru is a student, not a guru. There's a lot of gurus out there. And I obviously look at the ones in my field. If I was a doctor, I'd probably look at doctor gurus. But in marketing, I have to look at marketing gurus because that's my peer group. And I look out there and go, give me the statistics. Give me the data. What have you actually done? Because I hear what you're saying and I know that you're training people, but have you done it? And that's probably one of the problems I had when I was in college, was there was a whole lot of yap and not a whole lot of do, and there was a whole lot of structure, and I get very afraid for our educational system, because we teach people what to think and gurus teach people what to think. And a really great teacher teaches how to think. So if they're not teaching you how to think again.
Exactly. Well, thank you. Well, I just adore you. I admire your brilliance, your success, your savvy. And then I just adore the human being you are. And I'm just so grateful to call you a friend and that you're in my life. So thank you for being you and the incredible human you are.
Yeah, I take that and I appreciate it. It doesn't sound like we're talking about me when you say it. But I think the world of you as well. And I appreciate you inviting me here. And I hope that that when someone listens to this episode, that they found something useful, because that's why we did it.
Well, I have a whole page of notes, so I know that will be the case. All right, Ron, thank you so much. I'll see you at the Deeper Dinner Party, and you'll be our featured guest and speaker. So again, you offer so much to my life. So thanks again.
You bet. Thanks.
If you're inspired by today's show and you would like to learn more about my money coaching, here's what I need you to do. Head over to Kristina.com/call. That's KRISSTINA.com/call, and book an appointment to speak with me. In less than 30 minutes, we will get absolutely clear on why you're not earning enough no matter how hard you work, why you can never get ahead no matter how much you earn, and what you need to know in order to finally have the time and money freedom you're working so hard for. Remember, you're not alone. 95% of Americans are one life event away from financial crisis. I will be the first person to teach you why this is the case and how to be in the other 5% that has no fear around money. No one can do this alone. You need expert help. I've helped everyone from modest earning professionals to those earning 8 figures per year get off the financial hamster wheel and finally win the money game. I look forward to helping you too. Head over to Kristina.com/call and book your call with me today. I'm Kristina Wise. Thank you for spending your valuable attention with me today. We will meet again soon.